welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe, and happy holidays to everyone. As we prepare to welcome in 2012 and enjoy the coming light of the new year. And have you been looking up at that glorious Mother Moon? She has been fabulous. Didn't she just reach out and touch you in your heart? Well, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and if you're new to the show, I'm the author of the two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and what I like to call its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Some folks at the Joseph Campbell Foundation gave my book a thumbs up. It's been sold in museum bookstores and won awards, so I hope you'll check it out on my website and learn more about my work. Maybe even consider these books when you have to give a holiday gift or a birthday gift, or just maybe pamper yourself or a loved one. While you're there at my website, KarenTate.com, take advantage of the free downloadable meditations. They're my gift to you, my listeners. You were just listening to a snippet called Sacred Alchemy from the wonderful artist Diva Haley. And if you want to find out more about Diva and her music, you can find her if you just Google Diva Haley, or Sacred Alchemy is actually the name of the CD, as the snippet was. Tonight's my great pleasure to have two wonderful guests on the show. The first is Brandi Gallagher of Our Eco Village, and we're going to be discussing the state of cooperative culture in North America, or Lifeboats for the Future, Can We Really Pull Oar Together? Then just afterwards, Victoria Dorvesha will be talking to us about the beloved Dances of Universal Peace, a unique spiritual practice you'll certainly want to know more about, and if they're in your area. I can vouch for how much ecstasy you can come away with from those dances. They're really fabulous. But first, just a few housekeeping tidbits. I am really excited about the new addition to my show. Starting last week, because you asked for it, I'm doing Sacred Salons, or you might call it Ritual, on the radio. Some of my listeners wrote in and said they love to hear me interview guests, but they've also enjoyed when I've occasionally done meditations or offered wisdom teachings or ritual on the show, and you want more of that, especially those of you who might not have a local community or practice as a solitary. So your wish is my command. The first show of each month will be Sacred Salons, Ritual on the Radio, so you can connect with those of like mind in a more sacred way. What I'm trying to do is exemplify insight into goddess-inspired living. I hope you'll tune in and send me feedback. So far, the feedback's been good, but let me know what you like and what you don't like. Tell me what you think. Now, last week, with the birth of the new show and the new year, I gave away three copies of my book, Walking an Ancient Path. The winners were Sarood, Kimber, and Loreen. The books were mailed yesterday, ladies. You should have them shortly, and I hope you enjoy them. Please get back to me and let me know. I'll no doubt be using parts of the book for ritual, readings, and meditations during the Sacred Salons. And don't forget our monthly Sacred Sundays at the Green Man Store in North Hollywood on Lancashire. Our next service for men and women is January 29th at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and the theme is Resolutions and Return of the Light. We have something very special planned for this service. I hope to see you there. And please, if you come, introduce yourself and let me know you're a listener. For more info, please email me at KarenTate108. At ca.rr.com. Let's see. I want to remind you that you can always catch any show from the archives. Remember to listen at 6 p.m. Pacific, and later on at your convenience. There, the shows usually come up about an hour after we go off the air. And if you have a question but can't tune in live, you can always email me ahead of time before a show, and I'll be happy to ask my guest your question. And as always, thanks for your input and feedback. You are gas in my tank. So stay tuned in. Call in if you like. The show number is 718-766-4662. So without further delay, let me welcome Brandi Gallagher to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Hello, hello, Karen.
Hi, Brandi. Thank you so much for being on the show. I believe you are calling, is it from Canada?
I am. I'm calling from Shawnigan Lake, which is on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, right here on the coast. So
okay,
thank you for the privilege of tagging in with you all that way down south.
Well, let me read a little bit of your bio for listeners so they sort of know a little bit about you, if that's okay.
That'd be great.
Okay, so Brandi Gallagher, previously McPherson, she has a BSW and an MA. She's one of the original founders and developers of Our Village, and that's in Vancouver Island, British Columbia. She is also the executive director of Our Community Association, a nonprofit society dedicated to outreach projects, local and international, and the development of Our Eco Village as a demonstration or model of a sustainable village. Her sustainable land management planning and ecological design work has made her the main proponent behind the Canadian precedent-setting rezoning, which has allowed for the legal political community framework containing multi-use allowances for eco-villages and shared land projects across Canada. Born and raised in community, her life work has been focused around the development of sustained community. She's the developer of Topia, T-O-P-I-A, the Sustainable Learning Community Institute, which operates on site at our eco-village. With a deep compassion for people in place, Brandi works with other communities and projects to find their way through regulatory and legal processes, which challenge the development of legitimate models of land use, alternative building, ownership, and governance. The intention to have individuals and communities step aside from their rank and roles to enter into a more connected sense of community building is at the heart of her work. She provides these services through her business, Sustainable Community Solutions Consulting, SC2. She's also published, her work is a documentary titled Creating Topia, A Journey of Developing a School of Sustainable Community Building. She's featured in the movie Escape from Suburbia and the documentary Peak Moments, Creating the Impossible. Look for the wide variety of articles written and web-based interviews documented in relation to her work. Wow, that sounds like you're doing some tough stuff up there, Brandi. Is that the case?
Yeah, who knows where our life path is meant to lead us. I actually came into this as a therapist who focused on community and high-risk youth needs and really structuring things in a very different way. And the journey has sort of taken me into working on regulatory processes and looking at community from a whole different, broader way of being.
Okay. So, for those of us who have never heard these terms before, why don't you start out by telling us what is when you say cooperative culture in North America, that's what we're going to talk about. But what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the big question. And 12 years ago when we founded our eco-village, we started out with this idea that a place could be created as a commons that could be created simply by community, for community, through community. And if you can kind of imagine, that's where our family and friends started to raise their eyebrows. And a lot of them asked, like, are you for real? And do you really think people are going to care enough about climate change and peak oil and all these different issues? And is that for real? And do you think folks are going to get off the couch on Saturdays and come to work parties? And all kinds of people are going to co-create and manifest something like this together? And furthermore, where's your business plan? So, you know, that really started us out on a journey of, yeah, what is community? What does that really mean? And we set about a very large visioning process. Some would probably say much larger than we could possibly take on, but perhaps that's the truth about who and what is community. And, you know, eventually there comes a realization that maybe community isn't a geographic area or it's not a particular aggregate of people, but maybe it's a way of being. Maybe it's something that there's a reason why 10,000 people came through our eco-village in some way, shape, or form in this last year. And there's this deep yearning somewhere in the peoples that is being awoken. And folks are showing up from every walk and talk of life. And what does community mean to each of us? And how can we find that shared meaning together?
Well, it sort of sounds like what you're saying is, to a certain extent, it starts with a state of mind. Would that be right?
I would say a state of mind and a way of being.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would just imagine how difficult this must be. I mean, the first thoughts that come to mind are like a commune or a kibbutz. Is it anything like that at all?
Well, I grew up on a good old-fashioned commune, so I'm kind of the next generation, and perhaps we've sort of transformed that ideal and impulse that we had in the 60s and 70s for sure into maybe the next evolutionary step. A lot of folks use the term intentional community. In our case, we also use the term eco-village because we're part of a movement of intentional communities and eco-villages around the world. And so David Corton, who's a known author, termed the idea of lifeboat communities. And a lot of people refer to eco-villages and intentional communities as those kind of lifeboats for human beings to drop into and experience or have experiential learning about a whole different way of being in relationship. So with ourselves, with each other, with the land, with, you know, some greater good, whatever language we might all use for that, but something bigger than ourselves, and to really find a different way of relating in the context of the ecosystem of our lives.
So, Brandy, are you talking about a community where people actually, to a certain extent, live in a shared geographic area, or is it people can be anywhere around the world, but they're using the same ecological principles, or you know, like permaculture farming or things like that in their communities, or is it both?
Well, it is both. In the example of our eco village, we're simply a 25-acre sustainable living demonstration site and education center. And we're a park, we're a school, we're an organic production farm, and a residential village. We have food services and accommodation services and a whole bunch of social enterprises on site that are related to agriculture. So it's that real kind of, if you were a designer and you were using the language that was in my bio, people understand those structures as kind of ecological design or triple bottom line living. And those are all true as well, but what's the people element underneath it? Our is an example, again, that's tied to examples all over the world, and those principles, especially within the eco-village movement, hold fairly true, whether it's an urban or a rural example. The principles of sustainable living really infiltrate all and connect all of those different places and ways of being in the world and cultures.
So are you, and forgive me, the picture still isn't getting clear enough for me. Are you off the grid? Or are you providing all your food, all your electricity? Does everybody who live in the eco-village, are they supported somehow through the village? Or do you have to work, you know, at a regular business away from the village? You know, just, I guess, sort of keep fine-tuning the picture for us.
You got it. All those you just named are really particular aspirations that most places have. And I would venture to say right now that we don't actually have an example on the planet of a sustainable community, not by means of people's relating and relationships, nor by means of food systems or economic systems or environmental impact in the systems and the way we live. We're all really searching and attempting that aspiration, but we don't have any examples of arriving yet. So
that must be tough when you have to create it and you have no role model.
Right, and you know, a lot of us have probably spent large parts of our lives looking back in history and time and looking at village culture throughout different ways of people's living. And have we had sustainable Aboriginal cultures or ways in the past? And some element is the opportunity to borrow from traditional knowledge and weave that forward with the innovations and the future of where humanity is or may be heading, and trying to find a balanced place in there. How do we continually reinvent ourselves on this planet on some level, and also not discard the deep knowing that has come from generations before? Because we, you know, some people think we're at a very critical conjuncture, and here we are in 2012.
So Brandy, what have been the biggest obstacles? I don't know if that's the next logical question, but aside from not really having a template to follow, you know, having to dream it up, vision it up yourself, what are the things that stand in the way?
Well, yeah, the good point is once upon a time, 12 years ago, there wasn't a handbook for developing eco-villages on the planet. There is now. There's authors of those kind of here's how-to steps, with people really attempting to look at sustainable living. But with or without that, the barriers still remain. The known essence of our trajectory for sustainable living, pretty much always the first line of barrier that people identify are regulatory processes. And you alluded to that in my bio, not the direction many people in a place like this thought we were going to go to do the deep work. But it is true that land use allowances, construction permitting, finance models, taxation, all these things are often quite simply set up for conventional mainstream cultural context, and we're trying to create alternatives and innovation. So our first really big barrier is those regulatory processes. And yet, though we've taken that on for 12 years, I think people are really starting to identify that there is an underpinning challenge that we have as a peoples on the planet at this time, that the major barrier is our human perspective of how we live and work together as a humanity.
All right, so let me hold that thought. Let me just go back to what you just said and see if I understand. When you say that you're having problems with the regulatory system, is it because you're not trying to build a subdivision? You know, you're trying to build something that's a little bit more of an alternative lifestyle where maybe you, I've never built a subdivision, but I can imagine maybe if you're going to build a dome house and, you know, or maybe it's going to be hay bale houses or like the Hobbit houses, you know, where they're built into the side of a mountain or something like that. Is it because these are not sort of your mainstream construction that you run into the regulatory process?
Oh, absolutely. Imagine bringing together every stakeholder going to try and include every activity they're involved in, and then think about the challenges that might present. So,
give me some examples.
Designing the acre living site, imagine coming into a space that it is farm-based, so immediately think about how much land are we going to take away from our food production and food systems analysis to have space for people to live. Like, what is the footprint that a piece of land can hold, and the spirit of the land, how much can that be a container for all the learning of 10,000 people who come through here? In just a 12-month period of time. So we've got, again, this is a park, so a third of the property that's really sensitive ecosystem area we've put into park space and protected forever for future generations, sensitive habitat and just really amazing deep ecology. We're also...
Okay. So in other words, like, I know they're trying to build a community near where I live, and, you know, some people want it because it's going to bring jobs, but some people don't want it because it's going to affect the ecosystem. There's going to be more traffic. There's going to be more pollution. It's going to be more people using the water. You know, they're going to deplete resources. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about, too? You know, it's sort of like the overall plan is difficult to come up with because you don't know how much land you're going to need to grow food versus how much land you're going to need to build houses, kind of a thing.
Well, that's where permaculture design comes in, and you mentioned that before. A lot of people think about permaculture design by definition as taking natural resources and human resources and realigning them till they're the most mutually beneficial with the least harmful impact. So people in place and bringing it together in a way that has systems that close the loop. So, for example, we just talked about housing, food production, protection of ecosystem areas, and we also have education. So everything that happens here becomes a learning process. You can't actually go and eat something without kind of thinking about deconstructing what's on your dinner plate and where did this come from and how far did it travel. But you're also sitting in a building that's made with all healthy, natural, organic materials or diverted waste streams. So all these principles of sustainable design. But when you say to local government, well, we'd like to build a community project that includes everything and all of that and then some, the first thing that folks answered to us, well, that's really a beautiful vision, but you know, it's not legal. You cannot be a school and a farm and a housing project and a park and have food services and accommodations and small businesses all in one site. That's about
why
use zonings.
Why not? I mean, don't they do it at like the national parks and stuff? I'm thinking about the national parks that are, it's the national park. They have hotels at the park. They have food services. I mean, is it because it's the government that's done it and not private individuals?
That's a really good question. Essentially, I would respond that it's because we have compartmentalized and fractured most of our legal systems and the infrastructure development of how we live. And so with that, we've got laws and policies and bylaws and constitutional agreements that all say that things have to be a certain way, but they're not necessarily the logical process of best practices. And they may well have been decades ago, for example, within building codes here in British Columbia, but the quality of wood that is harvested is so much different. So first we start out saying we'd like to do all of these different land use elements, and we have to take on the zoning. Then we had to take on the building codes in British Columbia because we do build straw bale and earthen construction buildings here and have those beautiful little hobbit homes that you just described. And we do salvage all kinds of waste streams, but no sooner do we put all that together in food systems and 11 universities and colleges use the site and K-12 local and international public and private schools come here, an incredible amount of interface. And then the question would be, wow, how do you own that kind of thing? Because, you know, in our cultural connect on the planet, we say we have to, you know, have a title on something and somebody has to own it and be liable. So we actually had to work for a couple of years. For 6 years, we've had a legal team working with us to help create a hybrid multi-stakeholder cooperative that's legally incorporated. And this is great. Innovation, lots of award-winning things that we do around here. And then we've painted ourselves outside of insurance. How do you tax a place like this? Because it's many, many things. It doesn't really fit into the box anymore.
I see. Wow. So I mean, I sort of get the feeling maybe when you started all of this, could you even fathom the challenges that you were going to face to have to figure this all out?
A lot of people ask what kind of professional team was behind this project. For a North American example, it's outstanding. It must have been the greatest minds and the highest talent. And we always have to respond that our greatest attribute was a deep level of naivety. And, you know, sometimes the lack of awareness is bliss, that when you don't know what you're getting yourself into, there's no sense in being afraid. So maybe life's just like that.
You know, Brandy, I have said that so often. Most of the big projects I have done, I had no clue how hard they were going to be or how complex or what kind of effort they were going to take when I started. So I know exactly what you're going to meet. You're like the fool of the tarot deck. You know, you just jump in and you learn on the job.
Absolutely. And there's deep beauty in that. Like there's something that creating the impossible becomes a game. It becomes a way of living. You risk it all to have it all the time. And, you know, quite frankly, it is still stated ongoingly that this place is impossible. It'll never last. It can't happen. Now we're building the zero-mile meal eatery.
So tell me, what do you have there on site? And tell me again how big it is, because I've already forgotten.
Oh, it's 25 acres.
Okay.
And when you come in, you come into a community commons. We have a huge, 2,000-square-foot classroom that's made with all recycled materials. Absolutely beautiful. There's beautiful shops and barns and livestock and poultry areas. Acres and acres of food. including greenhouses, our office. We have an eco bed and breakfast. We have a healing sanctuary where healing practitioners come in from doctors of Chinese medicine to shiatsu therapists, massage therapists, and people from on-site and from the wider community use that space for their practice. There's also a group room in there. We have an art studio that's built by artists for Artist 3. And we
Brandy, do you want me? I can play a little bit of music while you get a drink of water. Would that
be
helpful?
Sorry, I keep trying to have a drink of water. I just I swallowed a cough drop while I was talking to you. So we also have an affordable housing cluster that we've just started on, and this is a real tour de force. Part of what we do is work on the transformation of relationship, where in activism or in work around the world, a lot of people have kind of taken on fighting for change. And part of a place like this is to create the opportunity to engage and maybe dissolve this whole notion of us and them. So are regulatory authorities the problem? No, actually, that might be the place to engage and create solution. So this place has worked really hard, and our team and a lot of people from wide and far have worked really hard in engaging all levels of community. We always say that it's not really sustainable yet until we have business and corporate, government, academia, and the grassroots community all in as stakeholders on Project Element. And so with that now, we've just, this has kind of been our heart's desire for the last decade, but we've just stepped forward with doing an affordable housing affiliate project to create healthy, affordable houses out of natural and recycled materials.
So that's going to be there on the 25 acres too.
Yeah, we're just bringing the first building to lock up.
And now the people who live there, will they somehow, their employment somehow be connected, or will they just be renters, basically?
No, in order to have a long-term relationship living on the land, folks that choose to live here have a role. They are stewards in the space. So whether they're teachers or food producers or elders that really hold counsel with the rest of the group and help really kind of guide the process. And the whole acronym of our eco-village, One United Resource, means that we each have a place. We each bring something to contribute. And some folks choose that in a longer-term format as being a resident here. And it's really an immersed lifestyle. There's no kind of stepping out in our way of being from that commitment we have to service and to living sustainably.
So I guess maybe use yourself or somebody who's associated with the project 24/7. What is it they do there?
Well, we could be folks that are working on overseeing all the organizational processes, and that could be all the legal and administrative work. It could, and we do a lot of research here. Some people are the folks that lead our food production team and are responsible for acres and acres of food being grown in the ground and our livestock and our poultry. Other people run a kitchen crafting program and pump out sometimes hundreds of meals three times a day out of our kitchen. For a long time, we had an outdoor kitchen right in the garden. We have builders on site who are the most extraordinary artists and create construction projects that are sculptures of art.
Wow. Well, I'm impressed. I'm impressed, and I'm going to have to go on your website. Are there pictures to see everything? I would imagine that there must be to see what you've actually physically built there.
Yeah, there's a Flickr account on our website that has thousands of pictures, I think. So people have a great time, and we welcome people to pull those pictures off and put them into something that's of use to them and just sort of say where the places that they're taking them from. But they really are the most exquisite. Something happens when you step into buildings that are alive. I mean, these buildings are made of earth and stone and wood and mostly natural materials, and they breathe. They actually they have a dew point in the wall that passes moisture through so that it it's actually filtering the air and creating an air quality that it changes people's experience in that building. And there's a spiritual quality to an alive building that's not sort of built with processed materials. So
wow. So now, who actually owns the 25 acres and all the buildings and everything? I mean, is it this co-op of people?
Yeah, the land has actually had to been held in trust for 12 years now. This is kind of one of our major next frontiers. For the last 3 years, we've been trying to create a finance model because our eco-village co-op, this great, incredible, all-inclusive ownership model we created, of course doesn't fit into mainstream financing in the conventional finance world. So recently, after years and years of trying to put together our own investment corporations and different things and let go of the conventional financing we have through a local credit union, which we now need to sort of move to the next level, but we've had a national organization step forward, and they're carrying what's called a syndicated mortgage for this place. So years of barrier has just been transformed, and we're moving on to what's next. We've had investors show up locally, and a couple people from England and Wales just this week who are investing either direct cash or retirement funds, and they get a market rate of return, and it's all done through this third-party administration and with their lawyer and the main lawyer that leads it. But we're actually now creating our own finance package, and we're going to pilot it here, and like everything we do, give away all of our structure and our toolkit around that to other groups that need it around the world, and they can copy it and try and do the same with their own local variances. But it's really about community, investing in community, where we can actually look at how to direct. We actually call it the ethical investment mortgage. So people are picking ways to be socially responsible, but sometimes it's a country on the other side of the world, or in this case, we're actually looking at how to create models where we can invest in our community close to home. And whether that's financially or by volunteering, or by, you know, getting word out about stuff. This is kind of our idea of how to link communities to communities.
And now you said you've been at this how many years?
This is the completion of year 12. We're moving into the 13th year in 2012 here.
So are most of the people that started there, that are they still there? Are they still there now?
There was a team of 14 of us as advisors in the beginning. And most people are still connected to here, or, you know, in some examples, people have moved to the one person I talked about from Wales has moved to the other side of the world, but he remains connected and, you know, is always back to visit when he's in Canada. So people sort of self-subscribe to, I'm still in community no matter where I live on the planet. And it's really about choosing relationship and choosing family. But everyone's sort of interconnected still. And yesterday there was someone here visiting who said, wow, each person has continued on out of that team to do some really interesting and amazing things in the world. And nothing ever stays completely the same, but the linkages and the mutual kind of cross support in most all cases is still really there, which is kind of unusual for some community projects.
So now when someone starts something like this, you know, when we were exchanging information before we booked you on the show, you said something about redefining value and wealth. Is mm-hmm. that something that people do when they start a cooperative? They can't really look at value and wealth the same way we've been brought up to?
Yeah, that whole kind of, especially North American cultural context we've had of rugged individualism, and it's a way of being that certainly brought us through culturally, you know, a long process now. And yet I think there's a recognition that if we don't find a way to cooperate and create peace in our communities and in ourselves and in our relationships, we're not going to move forward in a very practical and healthy way. And, in fact, our future is in question at this point and on so many levels of how, you know, how will it look? And so, you know, as we're moving into that, the whole question becomes, how do we define the value of relationship? How do we define the value of a house we live in? Or do I have to own a car? Could I actually share a car with a whole bunch of people, lower my footprint? You know, could I not be part of a car share? It, economically, it's much more feasible. On a practical, ethical level around my footprint in the world and my carbon footprint, there's, you know, a whole analysis around that. But it's a big step for many of us because we've led such privileged lives. Once upon a time, and I've been doing a lot of writing about this, but once upon a time, the village culture, we knew, no matter how large or small the village was, we knew that our well-being was dependent on the greater good of the village.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at certain parts in our lives, we were assigned to different roles, and we used to, you know, bring in the resources to the village, and from that we were looked after. And now we've sort of gotten into this shift of, you know, well, I'm going to look after myself, I'll feed my family and myself, and then, you know, if I get my nails done, I can, and a massage, I can volunteer on Sunday because I'll have done self-care. And that might not just be the whole picture anymore. It has kept us going, but there's something else that comes to life when once upon a time we did realize that there's a different way of being in relationship where we're all taking care of each other and our elders and our children, and we live in a way that recognizes future generations. And as somebody mentioned to me today, that there's an Aboriginal knowing that speaks of future ancestors and this idea that the people of the future are also ancestors because they'll become the ones of the past, and that if we actually lived our life that way now, the value of our life and the value of the things we do or how we spend our time or energy units we call money, how we spend those, we might redefine that in a way. And, you know, you can actually take this right out onto spreadsheets on business plans, or you can have heart-to-heart conversations about it. It really fits in anywhere from banking to, you know, community circles with family and friends.
Well, I find this really interesting, and I think this is very goddess-oriented. I think this feels very sort of matrilineal or matriarchal oriented. You know, I can very well imagine, you know, in matriarchal societies when the women and children were at the center and, you know, and everything passed from, you know, the woman's family, you know, through the woman's family line and everything like that. I just have the sense that things were much more, you know, maybe family oriented. But you're also, you know, you're going even beyond that. You know, you're not just talking, you know, several generations of a family. I mean, you're talking about community interdependence, very much like it probably would be if you were in a Native American tribe or, like you said, an Aboriginal tribe or, you know, before society became sophisticated. It, you know, it, and I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, because now it seems as though that has outlived its usefulness, and, you know, we need to get back to more simpler times, and maybe the old, what I'm calling less sophisticated ways of living, are really much more interconnected and smarter ways of living when it really comes down to it.
Yeah, there's a practical interdependency that we once all acknowledged, and, you know, whether it's any part of our life, and there's a reason why so many people show up in a place like this just yearning for that deep connection, and there's somewhere alive in us that knows that calling of relationship. And I agree with you, this is, you know, as 2012 has dawned, there is this opportunity for the reawakening of women and community and culture shifting and the roles that we have always embodied throughout history to really stand forward and stand high now. And it's the time to create that transformation. And, you know, it's often been the women that call us back to the hearth and take, you know, embrace the children and the elders again and realize we're all in this together. And we talked about lifeboats for the future. Can we really row oar together? How can we become that ecosystem of humanity that also is in a prayerful way connected to the land and the systems of everything that keeps us alive, and not just sort of putting blinders on? And you know, there's a very strong opportunity of the women of the world now to help create that transformation.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, you know, how hard it is for women's communities just to get along, you know, much less live together. But I guess it's different when your life depends on getting along, as opposed to, well, I can just take my ball and go home if I don't like the way you're running this thing, kind of a thing, you know. Does that really where the rubber sort of hits the road, I guess, so to speak?
Yeah.
You know, because you're really, you know, you just can't walk away, you know, because you are seriously dependent on one another. You're not there. Well, I guess you could be there because you want to be there, but, you know, but oftentimes when you're in a setting like this, or if we're ever forced in the future for more of us to live like this, we will have a vested stake in getting along. I mean, there'll be a stronger incentive, I guess.
Yeah, well, it goes back to that old story of the tragedy of the commons. You know, as humans, if left to our own devices, would we just take more and impact the environment so much that it could no longer hold us, and would we overgraze and overuse? Or is it the opportunity of the commons? The idea of common share and that common connection means there's where wealth resides. There is more than enough on this planet for all of us. And in that incredible opportunity of sharing on a deep, deep level, do we have to be called to that by disaster? And, you know, Katrina has to roll through and level the playing field, and a whole bunch of people start to live and work together in a most amazing way, or, you know, other natural disasters we've seen environmentally, or other examples. It is the opportunity that we could actually bring ourselves there without having to have that kind of push or something so extreme, but that we could wake up. And I just did a TV show, actually. It's on YouTube, Peak Moments, called The Reawakening of the Village Heart and Mind, and talked a lot about this, you know, what is it that awakens in each of us? Is it not in our DNA somewhere to be the village culture? And what is it that reawakens when we get into that very blissful, aware state of knowing about relationship and that deep connection? But we're not really good at sustaining it now. Our heart knows it, our mind knows it, and yet we're working towards finding ways to stay in deep relationship with each other and the land. And, you know, that we don't have an example of anybody going there in the world, whether it's monasteries to ashrams to sort of farms. People are trying everywhere to move into that deep practice of relationship with ourselves, each other, and the environment.
So what do you think it is that's, well, aside, I mean, you've already said, you know, the you know, just regulation, everything is difficult, but what is it about us as humans that make it difficult? Is it our greed? Is it our inability to trust one another? Is it just the fear of this new, you know, this new way of being, and, you know, they can't, you know, they don't have successful examples to know that it's going to work. I mean, I'm sure you must have thought about this.
Maybe all of the above. And is it our ego that really just has kind of a barrier for us to move through that level of fear of intimacy or into me see? Could I fully show up in life and be seen for all of who I am and what I bring, all the less than positive and the positive, and be in that kind of relationship with other people and with the place? Can I really come openly to the environment in which I live in and be willing to stand in that naked way in the relationship of all of that And that is a big risk. And, you know, I'm talking in a very unusual way on purpose. But it is what is the conversation that seems to really call people to wanting to create change in themselves.
Very interesting. So would I be wrong to say it's really the more evolved among us or the more enlightened who are willing to even try this kind of thing? I mean, I can't imagine the Ayn Rand sorts, you know, who are, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, the rugged individualists, you know, are like, for instance, our conservative extremists, you know, who don't even care if other people are living under a bridge or not, you know, kind of mentality. I mean, I can't imagine those sorts being suited to this way of life. You know, they'd be corporate raiders would want to come in and try to figure out a way to sell off everything and, you know, and make money off of it some sort of way.
Yeah, well, you know, the conversation about the longest journey in life being from our head to our heart. and we're brought up in a culture of competition. And you know, so much of the world has been based on that. It's almost like a process of unlearning. And it'd be easy to hold ourselves separate. You know, maybe that idea that naivety was one of the greatest skills, but holding ourselves separate, like someone's enlightened and someone's not, perhaps the days of even separating ourselves on that level, perhaps those days are something we have the opportunity to change now, that there really is no us and them. It is we, no matter who we are. And I would venture to say, if you actually create a relationship with somebody like your bank manager or your dentist or the regulatory authority who's doing sign-off on a process, and we are the housewife down the road that doesn't seem to get a vote or the kids at the local school, but if we all treated each other outside of the role, or, you know, I know who that guy is, got a lot of power in his signature, he's not going to listen to this. But if we actually come together in relationship in ways that defies all of our roles and just acknowledges that we're actually all working on the same thing and we're not here to actually fight each other on it, but that's where creating the impossible seems to become possible. That's where magic resides.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, because what you're talking about is partnership and cooperation and negotiation and really domination and competition really have no place in that sort of a relationship.
And if you actually risk just not acknowledging power structures and sort of getting caught into that whole way of thinking and just dare to dance your way through relationships where you're willing to truly see another person and be with them in all of what they are, then suddenly you have incredible things happen. One of the main regulatory peoples that worked on our project around our rezoning that folks said was going to be the biggest challenge of everything, sort of the big bad meanie in the regulatory world and urban legends all over about him, but he's the guy that came to us in the very end and was the biggest advocate, and then he's the guy who came to us on the side the day everything was signed off and had big tears in his eyes and said, you know what, we talked about this happening 30 years ago and I'm here to start being part of making it so. And then he's the guy that led us back to his car, and you're not supposed to carry your personal effects in a government car, but he looked at us and said, you know, I'm an artist, you know. And this man pulled out these most beautiful, incredible Tonkas, like detailed paintings, and one of the guys on our team is a Buddhist, and he said, you know, to the scholar, are you a Buddhist? Those are beautiful paintings. And the guy said, well, yeah, I am, and he pulled off his hat, and he had a picture of the Dalai Lama inside the top of his hat, like right there in his crown chakra.
There, wow.
And you know, he's walking around with the Dalai Lama with him every day, and let it be a way to imagine that none of us could really need to project on each other who the other one is, that more than we ever imagine, the other person is carrying around the Dalai Lama in their hat or something in their, you know, breast pocket that's right over their heart that is so near and dear to them that we don't even know. But we're all human, and we're all together in this somehow. And then we stop treating each other so poorly, like he's a big bad meanie, or, you know, oh, you've got this role that I have to kind of tiptoe around. But we become people together in relationship on a new level.
Wow. Brandy, this is awesome. And let me just take a moment here to let my next guest know that I see her popping up on the switchboard here. Victoria, we're going to get to you in just a second. So please bear with me. We just need a couple more minutes here. So stay on the line. But Brandy, you know, as we close our talk tonight, I liked the last thing you said. It was beautiful. But is there anything else you think it would benefit listeners to know? You know, before we let you go to your important work in the world, is there anything else you'd like to say that maybe I haven't asked?
You know, there's something else we're playing at, and I invite people to this possibility. For the last while, we've been working on a green burial project, and it's a North American pilot we're doing called the Commemorative Conservation Scattering Grounds. In the project, people get to place their cremated remains here at our eco-village and create a legacy project. You know, instead of treating your body with formaldehyde, all the end-of-life planning is done in a really healthy and non-toxic way. You don't put up a big headstone, you put a food or a forest tree. It's a very beautiful construct around it. But it really begs to ask this question of all of us. If we're thinking about green burial on practical and spiritual levels, a lot of people in the dialogue are saying, wow, you know, I'm in that last third of my life. I'd like to start thinking about this. I do want to leave a legacy. I want to, you know, have all those kind of pieces of planning done in the best possible way. But another option in the conversation is to be talking to people in their teens and their 20s and their 30s and their 40s and their 50s, but all the way up to the other two-thirds of life, where what about if we lived sustainably and created our legacy ongoingly, and we started to live our life into the way we want to die, into the way we want to be known in the world, into the way we want to leave legacy. And so that our very actions and ways of being, you know, if we commit to a green burial or a way that we want to be known at the end of our life, we'll live our way into that all the way through our. When people talk about cradle to grave sustainability analysis, they're usually talking about building materials. And I would like to put out this idea of, what if cradle-to-grave sustainability was really a way of being that we took on throughout all of our life? And that's a really big hope as a possibility.
Hmm. Well, you know, when we talk about goddess spirituality and we talk about the role goddess plays in our life, we say she's with us from womb to tomb. And in a way, what you're saying maybe sort of feels synonymous with that, you know, we would live our life in that psychological construct that, you know, we would always be, you know, thinking that way.
And response-able, that we're each response-able on that level.
Absolutely. Well, Brandy, tell us how listeners can find out more. What's your website?
So you can find us at ourecovillage.org, www.ourecovillage.org. And we welcome people for visits and tours and longer stays. So there's lots of ways to connect, and all of it you can funnel through the website.
Wonderful, wonderful. I would just want to thank you so much. You're an inspiration. I look forward to learning more about it, quite frankly. Can people, for instance, if they want to be buried there at the at the village, are you providing that sort of a service?
Absolutely, and you can have your whole ceremony and end-of-life process here with all your family and friends and have organic food for days, and, you know, it really becomes a life celebration when you're in community on this level, and we support anyone and everyone through that process.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Brandy. Please keep in touch if you have any big new developments and, you know, you'd like to announce them. Please get back in touch, and we'll have you back on the show.
That sounds great. And please find your way up here and come for a visit in person.
Well, I'm tempted. I have to tell you, I'm really tempted because obviously I think we need a lot of change in our world. And, you know, I very much believe in the idea, you know, in the days of Goddess, you know, things were much more interconnected and much more tribal and much more cooperative and partnered and community oriented. And I think what you're doing is really creating a lifestyle that's much more in tune with, you know, with what the mother intended. It's much more natural. You know, I guess that's maybe one way to describe it. So,
and there's many women here on this land that would wholeheartedly be in the conversation deeper with you on that one. So, yeah, please find your way. We guarantee people that they'll leave here inspired and that they'll hopefully ripple that out into the world.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for leading the way, Brandy. It's awesome. Good night.
Okay, good night. Have a sacred circle dance conversation extraordinaire.
Okay, we will.
Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how her values and benchmarks just might save the world. And we've been listening to Brandy Gallagher. We're so fortunate to have her share her knowledge of the eco-villages and what it would be like to live in a cooperative culture in our future. And wow, it does feel like a goddess inspired living, doesn't it? Well, we are about to welcome Victoria to the show, and we're going to be talking about Dances of Universal Peace, but I want to take just a quick break here to read you something very beautiful that comes from the We Moon 2012 calendar. It's Gaia Rhythms for Women, and it's the creation story by Denise Kester. It's called The Birth of Gaia and Something New, and it goes like this. She is the daughter of chaos, born of star material, fire and ice, sound and fury, alchemical green and blue matter, orange-red magma spewing passionate heat, steamy beginnings, a universal elixir of life, never still, always in motion, changing, growing, dying, rebirthing, shape-shifting, dreaming, and imagining. She will always be in some form or another. She may shake us off and begin again. She may shape herself so that the paradise lost will be found again. But lately, in her perfect thunder mind, something magical and vital is stirring. Her dreams have been infused with unusual entanglements of ideas, exotic possibilities, of thought never before felt, bubbling up from the heart of her heart. Well, right after this musical piece by Son of the Wind Widow, we'll have with us Victoria Dorvesha, and we're going to chat about the beloved and wonderful Dances of Universal Peace. But first, for just a couple minutes here, I'm going to let you listen to some new music that I have on the show. It's by a group called Son of the Widow, and The Cut is Damn Car is the name of it. And Victoria, we will be with you in just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners. And we have next with us on the show Darvisha Victoria. She has been a leading groups in meditation, deep ecology, expressive movement, and the dances of universal peace for the past 20 years. It was her love of nature that led her in the early 80s to the Himalaya, where she encountered the Buddha Dharma and received teachings on independence. Since that time, she's focused on helping others realize that all beings are interconnected, and that a life dedicated to the service of the whole, the creative matrix, is our own best interest and the actual abode of happiness. A life dedicated to the service to the whole is what makes us happy. Isn't it interesting how my shows just flow together? We were just talking about cooperative living. And you know, I don't plan these things like this. It just sort of happens. Darvisha is from Silver City, New Mexico. She is the chair of the Leaders Guild for the Dances of Universal Peace, and she is a Sheikha in the Sufi Runhaniyat International Society. Victoria, I hope I didn't do such a horrible job pronouncing that. Did I get your title, Sheikha in Runhaniyat? Did I get that right?
The word is Sheikh. It's pronounced Sheikh or Sheikha, and that sounds fine, what you said.
Well, thank
and I
you.
I would make one correction on what
sure.
you read or said. Is when I received Buddhist teachings in Asia, they were on interdependence, not independence.
Oh, I'm
the
sorry.
We are not independent. We are totally interdependent.
Thank you. That's what I meant, but the wrong word came
right.
out of my mouth. So thank you for correcting me. It must have sounded silly when I started going off talking about cooperation and partnership, and I said independence rather than interdependence.
right.
Well, Victoria, I want to thank you for being on the show so much. The Dances of Universal Peace, I just love these dances. And, you know, I was introduced to them here in Los Angeles when I first moved here, I guess in probably the beginning or middle 90s. And I was just blown away with the dances. They're sort of a moving meditation, and you're going to talk about all of that. But I just want to tell listeners that this is really something I've experienced myself. And one of the reasons I asked you on the show, because they have now luckily come back to my community after being gone for a while, and I'm so glad to have them back because they really just create in you this feeling of peace, this feeling of ecstasy and bliss, this interdependence that almost as if, you know what, anything is possible. You walk out of the room loving everybody in the room, you know. The dances just sort of bring that out in you. I mean, is that the norm or am I just crazy?
Well, it's the norm for those of us who are drawn to them. Not everybody is drawn. Some people find them too intimate because they include partnerships in which we gaze into each other's eyes without talking, people you don't know, and you're always holding people's hands. So, and there's usually hugs afterwards. Yes, because everybody feels that way, but they're not for everybody. It's true. We get, but they have caught on fire, and they've just only continued to spread since they were first brought through in the 60s, and now they're all over the world, and more and more dance is being created. And
well, you know, it's funny.
The movement is flourishing.
Well, and I'm so glad of that because I think, well, like you said, everything obviously isn't for everyone, and I'm listening to what you're saying about maybe it isn't for some people because, you know, you have to look into each other's eyes and you might have to hold hands, and I'm thinking, so what's wrong with that, you know? I'm thinking square dancers do that. You know, we do that when we slow dance, but, you know, who knows, maybe that is a little bit too intimate for some people that, anyway, get over it. It's fun.
Well, it's, for many reasons, you know, and we'll get into that as we proceed. I mean, this moving together as a group in one way, and when you become unified, and you have a sense, a unity experience, directly experience that with you, everybody singing and moving together in the same way, and then that is what creates that sense of oneness that makes you feel by the end of the night that you do love everybody, and certainly that we're all connected.
Well, you know, my last guest was talking about, you know, people are yearning for this connection with one another, this interdependence that we've sort of lost in our modern society. And I think in a way this enables us to get a little piece of that. You know, I've never really analyzed it. I just allowed myself to feel it. But I guess if I were to analyze it on a, you know, psychological level, it makes sense with what you're saying, you know.
The first thing about that you're talking is that by going into this form, this practice, we connect with ourselves. So we're connecting with our breath. We're connecting with our body, with the movement of our body, the movement of our breath, the sound of our voices as we sing, and so we. We're becoming embodied, and as we embody ourselves, as we realize ourselves as who, with direct, if we're having a direct experience of ourselves, of our life force, then once we're connected in to ourselves and our life force, and all that is flowing through us, just like you read about Gaia. Gaia is moving through us, we feel that life force in this way, then that is, that's the foundation for feeling connected to other people.
I see.
First we connect ourselves to ourselves, then we automatically have this authentic connection with others.
Well, and I want to say to listeners that, you know, and encourage them to go to the website, dancesofuniversalpeace.org, I believe it is. Is that right, Victoria?
Yes.
And because, yes. You know, you don't have to, first of all, you don't have to be a good singer, because that really just doesn't matter. It's like a non-issue. And you don't have to know how to dance either. I mean, you can come to this with absolutely no training, because the movements are easy. They're very basic, and people are singing together. It's not like, you know, there's a solo or anything like that. It's just group voice, and you don't even think about that so much, you know, when you're actually there. Would you describe the dances as sort of a walking meditation, or how would you best describe the dances?
That's good. That's a good way. And we actually, they do have a part of the practice is we actually have walks as well as dances, and they both start in the same way with this sense of embodiment, and the dances are based on a sacred phrase, and then the phrase is taught and explained and then sung, and then simple movements go with it, so that it's a repetitive that you keep repeating the same movement. So if you missed it the first time, you'll get it the second time around, and the same with the phrases, are the melodies are simple and not too many words, so they're easily learned.
Yeah, so it's almost chant-like in a way.
Describe that. Definitely. And so you've described it well. So a beginner comes and they just join in the circle, and they're shown what to do, and it only takes a few minutes to show a new dance, to teach a new dance, and then we all dance it together for 10 or 10 or 15 minutes. And then that's the end of that. And then there's another one. And they come from all different spiritual traditions, because it comes out of a line of universal Sufism. And so it's the embracing of all traditions. And the idea is to try on the worship style or the devotional style of different traditions. It's not like we actually go deeply into each religion or tradition, but that we understand a little about how it is in that tradition. So in that way, we're embracing that tradition and showing that we our tolerance and our acceptance of all traditions by trying on just a little taste of that tradition. So
well, I know
song,
I was at a group dance Saturday night, and just to give listeners an example, I mean one of the dances had a very Native American feel. The movements.
Were you with Lakshmi?
Words. Yes, with Lakshmi. Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
And another was very Hindu oriented, and another felt maybe it was kind of Jewish. And I know I've been to ones before that the words reflect, you know, Anna and Mary Magdalene. I mean, really, it's just, it's beautiful because it's all over the place. It's universal. And sometimes the words are in English and sometimes you're repeating, you know, Hindu words, but, you know, they tell you what they are and you know what you're saying. But it's all very reverential. It's all very prayer-like. I guess that's how I would describe it.
Yes, I think you're doing a good job. I think the sense of being able to show your devotion and to feel devotion and not be embarrassed by it, but to actually be with a group of people who are feeling that devotion together, I think that is definitely part of the ecstasy. We all have that innately, but there's not a lot of places where we can just come and just be devoted together. And
well, you know, it makes me think of what it, you know, to sort of piggyback on what you're just saying. You know, I grew up a Catholic, and I'm thinking about what it was like to, you know, that version of showing devotion together was you went to church on Sunday and you stood up and you kneeled down and you sat down and you stood up and you kneeled down and you sat down and you listened to somebody talk at you and maybe you sang. But this is so much more participatory. This feels so much more sacred. But at the same time, it's almost, you know, it's more communal in a way, too. You know, you feel that interdependence. You feel, I don't know, I've never felt like this going to church. Let me just put it that way.
I know. And then, of course, there is the component of the dance. And dance has always been sacred. And all traditions all traditions start originally in the earth, and people's relationship to the earth and the sun and the rain and their food, and that's how religion starts. And all of religion is earth based, and they all dance is a part of the form from the beginning of time. If we feel ecstatic, we dance automatically. But if we don't feel ecstatic, if we just go to a dance meeting and we start dancing, it will cause us to feel ecstatic.
Right.
So
yeah, and it is very
the means
earthy.
And an end.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It does feel very earthy. It does feel very natural. I like that it's you know, there are a lot of men show up, so you don't end up with just a woman's circle. Although some circles are just women, but you know, it feels like a real reflection of the community. I think, you know, people from all different walks of life really show up and do these things. So Victoria,
it does create a sense of community, and it it can be used to create community in with people who have certain organization where they want people to feel more connected. It perpetrates connectivity.
Well, you know, I was just thinking if you were going to meet with a group of people that you thought the meeting was going to be a difficult meeting, it would be interesting as an experiment if you had these people dance together for an hour before they tackled whatever their business was. It would be interesting.
Exactly.
What the outcome would be, you know, how they would treat each other and what the outcome of the meeting would be when, you know, after they had done those dances.
Absolutely. And, of course, we have an organization, so we have meetings. So, we conduct our meetings like that. And also, not just at the beginning, but when you hit a rough spot, we jump up and dance. And, you know, our goal is to have, you know, the Congress dancing or the boardrooms, the people,
right,
the
right.
Corporations.
Yeah, I like that idea. I think it should become a new law.
Right.
So, Victoria, how did you first find the dances?
Well, I was studying sacred dance at the time. I was, as I was saying, you know, the dances, has always been a sacred art. It only in more recent centuries became something that was used for, sexual titillation of men and so forth. In all traditions, if you go back, the dance is part of the form of sacred devotion. Anyway, I was interested in some modern teachers in the Bay Area who use movement as an awareness practice, self-reflection, self-awareness, and embodiment for our growth, for our development. And so I was actually studying with a number of women teachers, but in the midst of that, I stumbled into this form, and it had more of a political overtone because of its being called Dances of Universal Peace, the universality of it, and also, as we've talked about, the communal aspect of it, the group aspect of it. I also had a strong Buddhist practice, meditation practice. And Sangha is important in Buddhism, but there is generally, even though it's emphasized, there isn't so much community activity in most of the Buddhist Sanghas. So you're often not likely to get so close to a community. So I was drawn to the communal aspect of this form, and of course the dance itself.
Okay.
And the music was new for me. I was not, I like to dance to music, but I had not been a musician or a singer,
mm-hmm.
At least not overtly, you know. So.
And, well, I mean, the dances that I've been to, it's either a drummer on a doombeck or sometimes a guitar. Or a frame drum, you know, usually there is actually some sort of, you know, there is a musician there at the center with the teacher who leads the dances.
Right. It starts with that live music, and those are the three instruments we use the most, although, you know, keyboards and other drums and any musical instrument is always welcome. But, yes, it's live musicians in the center. And that center holds, that music is what holds the mantra, what holds the dancers.
So, now, where did the dances come from?
So they came to a man that we call Murshid Sam Lewis, who lived from 1896 to 1971, but throughout most of his life he was studying. He was drawn to Universalism, first exposed to it through the Theosophical Society in 1915. And then he studied with various spiritual teachers for a number of years. And then in 1923 he met Sufi Inayat Khan, who was the man who brought Sufism to the West. And he was just in that process when Sam met him. And somehow, between all his practices, and that would include zikr, which the Sufi men do, which is a practice of chanting and movement, just like a little bit like the Jewish davening. There's more dynamic movements. So he had done that, but he had been studying all these traditions, and somehow it came to him in a dream, his first dance. But the idea being that, like the zikr, but using it from phrases from all traditions, that you would start with the sacred phrase, as does the Sufi zikr, and then have the music come to the phrase, and then the movement would come. So he began doing these dances using phrases from different traditions.
Okay. Now I was looking at what I found interesting, that somehow Ruth St. Denis also was involved. I didn't know a lot about Ruth St. Denis, but as I was reading about her, they said in her early years she performed dance translations such as Radha and Incense, and she brought to the stage Mother Mary, Kuan Yin, the Yogi, and other figures of divinity as she danced her vision of each from her own attunement to their inner realization. I found that really interesting. What do you know about Ruth St. Denis?
Well, yes. See, we consider her the grandmother of the dances. Just to dovetail off of what you've just said, her story is so interesting. She was already a professional dancer, but she saw a poster of ISIS. It was an ad for cigarettes in a train station or something. And suddenly she had this moment, and she got it. And so she got that she wanted to embody those deities. And the Sufis use a word, tasawwuri, which is this, and just, it's like this: what you devote yourself to is, at least if your concentration is good, is who you become or how you become. So we stay in close adoration of a certain quality or a constellation of qualities in a certain being, and we keep our eye on that. That's kind of our path. We keep our eye on that, and then we become that. So the Sufis call that tasawwuri. And so she did meet Hazrat Inayat Khan, who is the man who brought Sufism to Sam Lewis and to the West. But it wasn't that she knew about tasawwuri from him. It's that Sam was getting this message from different places, the same message that we become what we want, we embody. So the dances are either embodying a sacred phrase, but also a sacred phrase by a certain saint or prophet. Hmm. So as we get closer to that the qualities of that being by becoming them. And now the Tibetan Buddhists do the same thing in their deity practices. They visualize Tara, and then they say her mantra, and then they rise up as Tara. And this is what we do in the dances as well. So we're doing the same thing Ruth St. Denis was doing when she performed the yogi or the notch or the Kuan Yin. We're trying to be in that likeness, and not only through the chant, but also through our movements and in our body. I don't mean that it isn't staged and it's not artificial, but our movements do become refined as we become aware of ourselves and sink into our direct experience of what's happening in our breath and our sound and our sensations.
Well, that just adds that much more beauty to that my monthly gathering. I'm so glad I know that. I didn't realize that before, Victoria. That's
well, profound. You're in great hands there with Lakshmi.
Oh, she's awesome.
Isn't she wonderful?
Oh, she is. Well, yeah. Well, we've been talking about, you know, how unique this is as a spiritual practice. Is there any more to it that I haven't asked you that you know, listeners might find interesting?
Well, just that it is a spiritual practice, and it is one in, and nothing we haven't really said, but to say it clearly, it's one that's in motion, in movement, and in relationship, as opposed to most practices which are done alone. And so that in itself makes it quite unique. Just to continue the focus. So the focus in partnership is to see the divine in everybody, or the transpersonal. So the partnerships, the mask of day-to-day conversation drops away. There's no soon, as we get more comfortable and familiar with it, there's nothing artificial. We're not meeting each person with our personality, and nor are we looking at the personality in the other person. We're really relating to each other at the transpersonal level, just as divine beings, the little piece of that God that is in each of us. Then namaste, I honor the God within you. So that's how we're greeting each other through the partnership dances. So it's a good practice for learning to see that transpersonal aspect in people rather than to get caught at the door, that is, you know, at the facade of the personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could say, you know, the name, the Dances of Universal Peace, ultimately, Sam said, yes, you know, it seems to be about dancing, but it's really about peacemaking. And so it's, in so many ways, we are learning about peacemaking in this practice. It's also true that Sam said that the strength of peace comes from our being centered in ourselves, our own inner peace. You know, it's what makes us strong and makes us strong peacemakers. So.
When you're doing these dances, if you take a moment and just sort of look at the faces of the people around the room, maybe after you've been dancing for an hour, you know, you can just, their faces just sort of take on, I don't know, it's sort of a different look. You know, you said it's like we find the God within. It's almost like they take on some sort of an essence or a glow or an innocence, a vulnerability. I don't know, all of these different words seem to apply on some level. It's really as if our heart chakras are just overflowing, you know, when you're doing these dances. And you know, my husband had never done anything like this before, and I took him to Lakshmi Circle on Saturday, and I fully expected, you know, how men tend to be sometimes. You know, I didn't know if he was going to like it. I thought he would complain or he would be bored. He loved it. He was so into
it. Oh, how
wonderful.
I
felt
so
good
wonderful.
For him, because I could tell, you know, I could tell he was doing something new, and it was wonderful for him. And, you know, it just uplifts your spirit in such a profound way. It really does.
Well, you're saying, you know, what you're saying is absolutely true. I also, you used the word vulnerable. Part of what you were saying, I was thinking, part of it is simply that the mask of our daily, you know, daily lives drops away, and that is our innate, that is who we are innately. Our innate goodness shines through. But you also use the word vulnerability, and it reminds me to say they also work deeply at a therapeutical level, because I can say that from my own personal experience, because I when I first came to the dances, which was over 30 years ago, I still had some unresolved grief, a lot of unresolved grief. And I had handled my grief, which came about at an early age when my father died. I had always handled that by feeling it was not wanted in social circles, and so withdrawing when, you know, not showing my grief. Well, when you get into these circles, especially, I guess I would also like to say, we have public dance meetings like you did on Saturday, but the most of the dancing is done in week-long camps, where we just go deeper and deeper and get more and more ecstatic, and they're usually quite large. So the circles, there's like three or four circles, concentric circles, and a lot of musicians live, and so they're quite fantastic. But anyway, in something like that, as you know, the days go by, of course you touch into many of your feelings, and if you have feelings such as sadness, and if you're in a partnership, you know, the partners keep moving. You don't stay with one partner too long. But let's say that your sadness is showing. Maybe you have tears going down your cheeks. What you see in the mirror in front of you is just someone who appreciates that you're in touch with your feelings, and you feel this complete support. You don't have someone handing you a Kleenex, trying to fix you. You have someone who's just accepting you as you are. So it becomes easier for you to accept your own feelings of grief and to show them to others, or whatever your, you know, whatever feelings you're processing. But it's also very magical at a therapeutic level.
Yeah, it is very magical. I'm glad you used that word, because I think that's another good way to describe it. Well, Victoria, now that we've tantalized everybody with how wonderful the dances are, and obviously it goes without saying, I wish everybody listening would go try to find one in their area and go every week or every month, because it gets that much better, you know, when you get to really know the dances really well, and you don't have to think about the steps so much, and you know the repetition in when you're familiar with them, it's even that much better. But how do people find out more about the dances?
Well, the website is the best way, and as you said, it's dancesofuniversalpeace.org, and I think that everything you need is there. That's the international website, and there is a North American website. All the regions, all the countries in the world have their own websites, but our North American website is Dances of Peace North America. so you could, Dances of Universal Peace, Northern America, so you could get in through that window just as easily as the international window. The international window has a lot of write-ups in other languages and so forth. It's quite exciting how the dances are spreading all over the world.
And you can actually go to YouTube, and there are, you know, where some people have videoed some of the dances, and you can hear some of the music and see some of the movement, and, you know, if you want to, you know, just sort of take a look at it, you're, you know, you can, you know, get a little bit of a taste of it before you actually go.
Yeah, that's a good way. I also have a website of my own, darvesha.net, which has some information on it as well. And, yeah.
Okay.
Also, you can find out about it through our organization is the parent organization is one that Sam Lewis started, which is the Sufi Rouhaniya International, and that website also is a way in.
Okay. Well, Victoria, thank you so much for being on the show and talking with me tonight about the dances. You know, it's my wish that, you know, millions more people find these dances, and, you know, it's just you know, good for the soul, good for the heart. It's good for the psychology, too. It just makes you feel good all over. And, boy, we sure need that today, don't we?
We do. And well, you are a wonderful advocate. I love how you've described them and everything you've said. It's been wonderful what you've said, and thank you.
Well, you know, they make me feel like a kid, you know. It just, I have such joy with the dances, you know, I really do. And there aren't many things that do that. So I'm just really being sincere.
We had one person who danced with Sam called him Joy on Legs.
Well, Victoria,
he was sort of the embodiment of that effervescence. So I think he'd be very happy to hear you describe them that way.
Well, that makes me feel good, too. Well, Victoria, thank you so very much, you know, for talking to me about this tonight. And who knows, maybe somewhere at one of these dance camps, because I'm thinking in the back of my mind, maybe by next, you know, maybe 6 months from now, you may see me at one of these.
Oh, you should come. Come with Lakshmi to the wilderness camp up in Montana this summer.
Well, I'll think about it.
Yeah. Okay, we'd love
right.
it.
Well, thank you so
All
much.
Right. Thank you, Karen. All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I just to get on to some a few announcements before the end of the show, and I wanted to let you know that airtime is no longer free to hosts like myself. I actually pay for the airtime to share with the community and give others a platform to share their work with you. So if you'd like to help me stay on the air, I'd appreciate it if you'd go to my website at KarenTate.com. Once there, click the button for the Goddess Store page, and if you go all the way down, you'll find not only some free stuff, like the downloadable meditations I mentioned at the top of the show, but you'll also see some PayPal buttons that will enable you to make some contributions. Remember, Goddess teaches us what you nurture and tend to thrives and survives, and what we neglect, well, it withers. And as an incentive for contributions, you will get, you know, some gifts depending on the amount of your contributions. But please, even if you can't afford a contribution, a large contribution, I am sincerely grateful to take smaller offerings. And you too will, you know, whether your contribution is large or small, you will get a gift from me for your generosity. Now, if you've stayed with me through this, you know, through the end of the show here, this is where you get rewarded. This is where you can win a copy of one of my past interviews that I've done on where other people have actually interviewed me, or where I've interviewed some people talking about sacred sites around the world. These are not available on any archive on the internet. You can only get them from me. And if you are the first to email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com, and you must tell me about yourself, why you'd like some of the interviews, and give me your mailing address, you will be the winner. I'm only taking one winner tonight. Now be sure to follow those instructions. That's part of how you win the CD. Tell me about yourself, why you'd like the some of the interviews, and give me your mailing address. And also, I want to make sure I point out that if you go to my website, please check out my YouTube channel, and you can hear some presentations that I've made, like, for instance, the one that I gave at the American Academy of Religion conference recently. Goddess, is a Democrat, the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. That talk is out now in article form in the journal put out by the Institute for Theology and Deosophy. And if you're interested in a copy of that talk, write me and I will send you the link. So, my dear listeners, as many of you know, adversaries of the Sacred Feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great She was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, well, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, and disrespected. That's why here on the show I am dedicated to recovering the great She, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, here we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are, how they have come to be turned on their head and so unnatural, and we're going to go about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, cooperation, partnership, it is women with our like-minded brothers armed with ideals of the Sacred Feminine who will set things back on course. And tonight, like every other night of the show, our listeners speak to these ideals of the Sacred Feminine. So let me once again repeat what have become the mottos for the show. The first comes as a quote from the 19th century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. It goes like this: all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. And the second, attributed to Gandhi himself. He said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Well, listeners, I really do believe that it won't be long, and the ideals of the Sacred Feminine, we will see that they have won. Well, I want to thank everyone for staying tuned in with me tonight. Next week, my guests are going to be Anne Newkirk-Niven. She's going to be talking about pagan publishing and community trends that she's seen as a publisher over the last few decades, and she may give us some insight on where she thinks things are going. After Anne, we're going to have Victoria Genovian. She's going to talk about prana power and the eight key breaths of life. And then the following week, on the 25th, Starhawk will be on the show. She's going to talk about her new book that's out, The Empowerment Manual, A Guide for Collaborative Groups. And we also have Zohara Hieronymus on the show. She's going to talk about her book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. And she's also the author of Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets. So we're going to be talking a lot about the Kabbalah and the Sacred Feminine as well. So, as we end the show tonight, let's see, who will it be? Who will it be? I think we'll play. Hang on, let me see what it's going to be tonight. Something unusual. Let's see if you like this. I've never used it before. It's kind of meditative, rather ethereal. It's called Star Song by Leah Scallion. Here it goes. So until next week, have a wonderful week, listeners. Have a sacred week. And look for those dances of universal peace in your area. I don't think you'll be sorry. Good night. Laika rodoya kia tuya.